Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the November 3rd Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, Colorado asks FEMA for aid, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. State pot tax hike fails, by Saji Hindi, the Denver Post. Oil and gas, interior to move ahead with lease sales on public lands, by Matthew Brown, the Associated Press. COVID-19, Colorado asks FEMA for aid. The state, which ranks fifth in the U.S. for new cases, is in need of hospital staffing. By Meg Winger, the Denver Post. About one in every 51 Coloradans is now contagious with COVID-19, as the state registers the fifth highest rate of new infections compared to population in the country. With the pace of new coronavirus cases accelerating in Colorado, Governor Jared Polis announced Tuesday that the state had asked the Federal Emergency Management Agency to send in medical teams to help in areas where hospitals are especially full. Over the weekend, he issued orders putting a 30-day moratorium on cosmetic surgeries, giving the state increased control over transferring patients and requiring everyone to wear masks in high-risk settings like nursing homes and prisons. The state also recently reopened metro area mass COVID-19 testing sites at Waterworld and Dick's Sporting Goods Park. Polis encouraged anyone with symptoms to get tested so they'd be eligible to get treatment with monoclonal antibodies as soon as possible. Monoclonal antibodies are lab-made copies of cells the body produces to fight COVID-19. They can reduce the risk of hospitalizations by 70 to 80% if given the first 10 days of infection, but they aren't useful once someone is sick enough to end up in the hospital. The rate of new COVID-19 infections in Colorado has accelerated over the last 2 weeks, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said. Only Alaska, Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming have higher case rates compared to the population. Most of the state's large counties have seen increasing cases, though the trend line is especially steep in Pueblo County, which is concerning, Herlihy said. It's probably not a coincidence that this is roughly the same time that Colorado saw rapidly increasing cases last year, though it's not clear if that reflects changes in the weather itself or in human behavior, she said. If the current trajectory continues, the state should stay slightly below the peak set in December of 2020, when 1,847 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19, Herlihy said. If transmission control goes down by 5%, though, it's possible the state could exceed the previous peak, she said. Transmission control is an umbrella term that includes a mix of individual behaviors, like wearing masks and moving gatherings outdoors, as well as public health measures, such as testing and tracing people's contacts. It's certainly a scenario we could see, she said. As of Tuesday afternoon, 1,254 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19. About 81% of those hospitalized were unvaccinated, even though only about 27% of Colorado's adult population isn't fully vaccinated. Children have a lower vaccination rate and account for 27% of the hospitalizations. The state's hospitals can handle a maximum of about 2,000 COVID-19 patients, assuming they have an expected number of non-COVID-19 patients, officials said. A bad flu season could throw that off, but Fortunately, that hasn't happened at this point. Unvaccinated people are about 3 times more likely to test positive for COVID-19 than fully vaccinated people, and are more than 4 times as likely to be hospitalized or die, according to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. It's never been more dangerous for an unvaccinated person right now, with a significant majority of hospitalizations coming from a minority of the population, Polis said. Polis acknowledged it would be tight for the next few weeks as the state's hospitals approach capacity, and said he and others are frustrated by the continued toll among unvaccinated people. To limit the damage, Coloradans need to get vaccinated against COVID-19 or get a booster shot, he said. Federal guidelines only authorize booster shots for certain groups, but Polis has encouraged anyone who got their last shot at least 6 months ago to get one. I have no qualms if unvaccinated people have a death wish, but they're clogging our hospitals, he said. Colorado's rank for hospitalizations isn't quite as bad as for cases. The state is tied with South Dakota for the 9th highest rate, according to data compiled by the New York Times. Nationwide, cases have started to rise again, raising concerns that hospitalizations and deaths could follow. The state is heavily promoting monoclonal antibody treatments as a way to reduce the strain on hospitals. Hurley, he estimated that if about half of people who are eligible for monoclonal antibodies receive them, it would cut hospitalizations at the upcoming peak by more than 20%. To be eligible for a monoclonal antibody treatment, a person must be at least 12, have mild or moderate COVID-19 symptoms that started in the last 10 days, and have at least one risk factor, such as being over 65, being pregnant, or having a chronic health condition. Statewide, 161 hospitals, pharmacies, clinics, and other locations are treating people with antibodies, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. 2 buses are also driving to areas without easy access, and 3 others will hit the road soon, he said. While monoclonal antibodies are helpful, the best way to prevent severe illness from COVID-19 is to get vaccinated, Hurley, he said. Full vaccination reduces the risk of hospitalization by about 94% for people under 60, though it's less effective in older people who are less likely to have a strong immune response, she said. We really do continue to see this as a pandemic of the unvaccinated, she said. Election 2021. State pot tax hike fails. Colorado voters also reject 2 other statewide ballot measures, by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Colorado voters defeated Proposition 119, an increase to the state's retail marijuana sales tax that would have helped fund tutoring efforts, as well as the 2 other statewide measures in Tuesday's election, according to unofficial results. The other 2 measures, Proposition 120 and Amendment 78, called for a reduction in property tax assessment rates and required for all states' spending to go through Colorado legislature, respectively. More than 1.2 million Colorado voters had cast ballots in Tuesday's election as of 5 p.m. About 31% of the state's active registered voters. Voters rejected Proposition 119 by 54.37% to 45.63%. Proposition 120 by 56.68% to 43.32%. And Amendment 78, which would have required 55% of the vote to pass, by 56.66% to 43.43% as of results posted at 10:08 p.m. Proposition 119 called for a 5 percentage point increase in the state's 15% sales tax for retail marijuana by 2024, starting with a 3% rate increase in 2022 and 4% in 2023. The money raised would have gone toward out-of-school enrichment programs with a priority on kids from low-income households. That had both bipartisan support and opposition. Proponents conceded defeat Tuesday, saying the results of the election would only make the achievement gap between students from wealthy families and those from low-income households worse. Access to affordable, quality after-school education services is not a possibility for many families living in Colorado, and we will work with anyone who has a better idea on how to tackle the problem. Chris Hubbard, a Yes on Prop 119 campaign spokesperson, said in a statement. Opponents had argued that the measure wasn't what it seemed and would have increased already high marijuana taxes, and that the plans lacked transparency for how dollars would have been spent. Momentum has steadily shifted against Prop 119 in recent weeks as voters learn more about it and how it would take money from public schools. Wendy Howe, co-Working Families Party state director, said in a statement Tuesday after early returns. Peter Marcus, a spokesman for Terrapin, a Boulder-based cannabis company, called Proposition 119 a misguided policy. Despite being significantly outspent by proponents, Colorado voters still soundly rejected using cannabis as a piggy bank for out-of-state special interest projects, he wrote in a statement. Coloradans understand that lawmakers struck an appropriate balance when they planned for cannabis taxes. Disrupting that system would only set successful regulation back. Proposition 120 and Amendment 78 were backed by conservative political group Colorado Raising State Action, and Executive Director Michael Fields conceded their defeat after 9 p.m. Proposition 120 called for cutting the residential tax assessment rate from 7.5% to 6.5% and commercial property tax assessment rate from 29% to 26.4%, with backers saying it would have saved an average of $1 billion annually. It was complicated, though, because the Democratic majority Colorado legislature passed bipartisan SB 21-293 this year in an attempt to thwart the measure by approving $200 million in property tax cuts for 2 years and changing the tax code classifications from two categories to six. Opponents of the proposed measure argued that a permanent tax cut would negatively affect local governments, special districts, and services residents rely on, and say with the passage of the bill, the ballot measure won't do what proponents are promising. By the time Senate Bill 21-293 became law, it was too late for Colorado Rising State Action to make the changes in the ballot language to what had become outdated tax categories. With Senate Bill 21-293 in effect, Proposition 120 would have only applied to multifamily residential properties and commercial lodging. I don't think that the vote reflects the frustration that people have with higher property taxes they're getting, Fields said, adding that the property tax issue isn't one that will be going away anytime soon. One of Senate Bill's 21-293 sponsors, Senator Chris Hansen, said he was surprised by the election results because of spinning by proponents and no organized campaign against the measure, but he said it would have been a backward move to approve it. As we look forward, I think hopefully the template from Senate Bill 293 is really a way to guide our future action, in that we need to look carefully at the economic conditions, what's happening in the housing market, what's happening in the property market, and adjust accordingly, Hansen, a Denver Democrat, said. And I think that's the job of the legislature. Amendment 78 had a higher threshold for passage since it was a constitutional change. It would have required the state legislature to sign off on its all-state custodial money, money that comes from outside the state government, including federal emergency funds, money from legal settlements, and grants. Proponents of the measure had said it would create better oversight of all money spent and would not allow the governor or attorney general, for example, to spend the money without approval. But opponents argued that it would have delayed funding in emergencies and hurt local communities by adding another layer of bureaucracy. A lawsuit to invalidate the measure was unsuccessful. The fact that voters were rejecting all three ballot issues Tuesday night shows that it's hard to get yes votes, especially on an odd ballot year, Fields said. Groups like the We Thrive Coalition, which advocates for an equitable tax code, opposed Proposition 120 and Amendment 78, with Amy Baca Olhert of the Colorado Education Association saying if the results hold, they show that Colorado voters are understanding the value of our public goods and services and that we need to devote funding to ensure that we have a Colorado that works for all. Oil and Gas, Interior to Move Ahead with Lease Sales on Public Lands, by Matthew Brown, the Associated Press. Billings, Montana. The Biden administration is planning to sell oil and gas leases on huge tracts of public land in the U.S. West, despite the Interior Department's conclusion that doing so could cost society billions of dollars in climate change impacts, according to government documents. Administration officials announced last week that government regulators for the first time will analyze greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels extracted from government-owned lands across the U.S. Burning those fuels accounts for about 20% of energy-related U.S. emissions, making them a prime target for climate activists who want to shut down leasing. President Joe Biden campaigned on pledges to end new drilling on public lands. Hundreds of parcels of lands that companies nominated for leasing were dropped from the sales because of concerns about wildlife being harmed by drilling rigs. Yet officials with the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management, BLM, said for now there's little they can do to prevent the broad climate change impacts from burning fuels extracted from the remaining parcels. That's in part because they can't discern the significance of emissions from government-owned fuel reserves versus other sources. Officials wrote in newly released documents. The determination applies to lease sales planned early next year in Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, North Dakota, and other states. BLM has limited decision authority to meaningful or measurably prevent the cumulative climate change impacts that would result from global emissions, agency officials wrote in their Montana lease proposal. Similar statements were included in documents released for sales in other states. The leasing plans could change as the administration continues to analyze greenhouse gas emissions and their effects on people and the environment, administration officials said Tuesday. The Land Bureau plans to defer leasing on almost 600 square miles in Wyoming, 213 square miles in Colorado, and 5 square miles in Montana because of the potential impacts to a struggling bird species, the greater sage grouse and migrating pronghorn antelope. Still, Wyoming has the most land up for new leasing, roughly 280 square miles. The so-called social cost of emissions from burning oil and gas from all the parcels, including more natural disasters, crop leases, and public health problems due to climate change, are projected to range from $630 million to about $7 billion, according to Land Bureau documents. The administration's decision not to cite the climate costs as a reason to limit leases frustrates environmental activists and others who have urged curbs in government fossil fuel sales. They said it undermined the president's participation in the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, where Biden and other world leaders on Tuesday pledged to cut emissions of methane, a byproduct of drilling. Harvard University economics professor James Stock said it was confusing for the administration to put a dollar value to greenhouse emissions, but then assert that such impacts are impossible to discern because of the global nature of climate change. To say it's too hard, they can't do that, that's simply not true. All of those calculations have been done, Stock said. This is very surprising to me and inconsistent with the Biden administration's climate goals. Similar determinations that U.S. fossil fuel lease sales should not be sharply restricted over global warming concerns were made under former presidents Donald Trump and Barack Obama. This seems to be as business as usual, said Jeremy Nichols with the environmental group Wild Earth Guardians, said of the upcoming lease sales. It flies in the face of scientists finding that any more fossil fuel production is unacceptable and countries need to find ways to limit production. Republicans and petroleum industry representatives were quick to slam Biden last week when he announced plans to analyze greenhouse gas emissions. The decision not to directly address them reinforces that stopping development on federal lands would have little impact on climate change, said Kathleen Sagama with the Western Energy Alliance and Industry Trade Group. Stopping all leasing and development on federal lands would have zero impact on climate change, as the production is simply displaced to non-federal lands or to OPEC or other foreign producers, Sagama said. Studies by independent experts have concluded that some, but not all, reduced drilling on federal lands and waters would be offset by crude imports. Approvals to drill on leased U.S.-owned land surged towards the end of Trump's presidency. Figures released Tuesday showed 261 drilling permits approved in September, compared to more than 800 during Trump's last full month in service in office. Land Bureau officials said in the leasing documents that their regulatory authority was limited to activities tied directly to oil and gas development, not the subsequent burning of the fuels. Instead, they propose curbing emissions by addressing methane leaks from oil field activities and other avenues. Thanksgiving. Question of vaccination looms over the holiday, by Christina Morales, the New York Times Company. For the first time in 2 years, Tim Wyatt is hosting a Thanksgiving feast at his home in Birmingham, Alabama, along with a traditional turkey. Wyatt will spend days preparing his slow-roasted pork shoulder with Alabama white sauce. His wife, Nancy Wyatt, will cook all of her enticing side dishes like sour cream mini muffins and sweet potato casserole with sage butter. Everyone from their extended family is invited, but Tim Wyatt has made a request. If you want to come by and eat his signature fall-off-the-bone pork, you have to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. I felt responsible for myself, my wife, and anybody else visiting my house that day, said Wyatt, 72, who expects at least 15 guests. Like Wyatt, many Americans thinking about hosting or attending a bigger Thanksgiving celebration this year are considering a question that has become sensitive and often polarizing. Will they and other guests be vaccinated? The age-old wisdom about dinner conversation is to avoid sex, death, and politics, said Noel Brewer, a professor specializing in health behaviors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Vaccinations have moved onto that list. Still, they threaten to complicate the holiday planning and the meal itself. People who get vaccinated can also be self-righteous, and some people who haven't been vaccinated can be belligerent, Brewer said, adding, that could really be a combustible mix. In interviews, many people, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, said they were planning to tiptoe around the subject. In some cases, avoiding a meal with those they might disagree with. Others who are immunocompromised or have children too young to be vaccinated are grappling with how to decline invitations from unvaccinated relatives, and some hosts worried about safety are drawing a line. Wyatt was talking on the phone with his sister last month about his Thanksgiving plans when he impulsively told her, "Tell your kids they can't come unless they're vaccinated." Within a week, he received a text message from his sister with a photo of his nephew at a pharmacy where he was getting a shot. Wyatt forwarded the picture to his daughter, Emily Plumley, 41, of Huntsville, Alabama. Her father's vaccine mandate put her at ease about the get-together. "I'm relieved for a sense of normalcy," she said. Last year, the pre-Thanksgiving concerns centered on social distancing and taking risks with the coronavirus. This year, the focus is on inoculation. More than 192 million Americans had been fully vaccinated as of Sunday morning, but that is only 58% of the total population. Those conversations are already happening as people send out invitations, said Richard Carpiano, a public health scientist who studies vaccine hesitancy at the University of California, Riverside. While lots of invitation lists are taken for granted every year, this year it provides the opportunity for people to actually set parameters, he said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance for the holiday season is that people should protect others ineligible for vaccines, such as young children, by getting inoculated and encouraging guests to be vaccinated. The CDC also advises that people gathering with others from multiple households in different parts of the country consider taking additional precautions like getting a coronavirus test beforehand. But many people oppose the vaccines for various reasons. Some said the stance had alienated them from their families and friends. In Honolulu, Rasa Fournier, a spokesman for the Aloha Freedom Coalition, an organization formed in September 2020 to fight against stringent health mandates in the pandemic, said she had invited family and friends, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, for a vegan Thanksgiving. "All of that fear and distancing is really awful, an awful way to go," said Fournier, 49, who is unvaccinated against the coronavirus because she believes the vaccines are not safe or effective, despite overwhelming evidence that they are. "We just want to live life normally and with love and with aloha." Fournier said the vaccine had been used as a way to divide people. "The vaccinated people will uninvite people, and it's incredibly hurtful and sad," she said, adding that she had lost many friends because of her beliefs. "Most Americans probably won't argue about vaccines at the Thanksgiving table because they normally gather with people they're politically aligned with," said Yana Krupnikov, a political science professor at Stony Brook University and co-author of Independent Politics, How American Disdain for Parties Leads to Political Inaction. "At all the same," Krupnikov said, "vaccines were a very personal matter for many people and could enter the holiday conversation." Even before the pandemic, Elizabeth Bossard of Bryan College Station, Texas, said vaccines were a sore subject for her family. "We just kind of listen and silently disagree," said Bossard, 36, who has been vaccinated and plans to observe the holiday at her sister's home in Houston. "No sense in arguing with people and making things unpleasant. We always get along at Thanksgiving." South Park creators buying venue. Save Casa Bonita dropping objection to restaurant sale. Lakewood Landmarks owner filed in April for bankruptcy, by Kieran Nicholson, the Denver Post. Save Casa Bonita, a group of local fans of the landmark Lakewood Eatery, has withdrawn its objection of the sale of the restaurant to the creators of South Park. A notice of withdrawal of objection to the sale was filed Tuesday in U.S. Bankruptcy Court, District of Colorado. Save Casa Bonita LLC, Save Casa, by and through unsigned counsel, hereby files its notice of withdrawal of the objection to the debtor's motion to sell substantially all of the assets, the Tuesday filing said. In August, Colorado natives Trey Parker and Matt Stone announced that one of their companies reached an agreement with the restaurant's owner, Summit Family Restaurants, to pay $3.1 million to make Casa Bonita's creditors whole and purchase operating assets. Summit had filed for bankruptcy on April 6 in Arizona. On October 18th, Save Casa Bonita filed a legal motion objecting to the sale, arguing that the purchase offer of $3.5 million was $400,000 higher than what the South Park team had offered, among other claims. An evidentiary hearing was scheduled on Wednesday, but it has been vacated due to the settlement and withdrawal, according to Tuesday's filing. After fully assessing the parties' positions and facts of this case, and upon the agreement of the parties, Save Casa hereby withdraws the objection to the motion pursuant to an agreement of the parties. The buyer and the debtor do not object to this withdrawal. Andrew Novick, a principal of Save Casa Bonita, withheld comment Tuesday. "I'm not at liberty to talk about it at this point," Novick said. "Some things are pending, and we will hopefully know more next week." Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Georgia Lois Burnett, February 22, 1927 to September 13, 2020. Lois lived a passionate life full of curiosity, encouragement, and joy. She is dearly missed by her family and friends. Isabel Cecchini, June 10th, 1937 to October 30th, 2021. Private family services will be held. See website for full obituary. Michael J. Farahur, 74, passed away on October 25th, 2021 in Denver. For full obituary, visit monarchsociety.com. Anthony Giuliano, September 3rd, 1935 to October 28th, 2021. Services at St. Mark Catholic Church on Monday, November 8th, 2021. Rosary at 10 a.m., Mass at 10:30, luncheon and interment at Mount Olivet Cemetery, 2:30 p.m. Visit HoranCares.com for full obituary. Teresa Lamorato, May 31st, 1930 to October 20th, 2021. Teresa Lenore Lamorito of Wheat Ridge, Colorado, passed away on October 20th, 2021 at the age of 91. A visitation will be held on Wednesday, November 3rd, 2021 from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. with a recitation of the Rosary beginning at 7 p.m. that evening at the Horan M. Conaty Funeral Family Chapel in Denver, Colorado. There will be a funeral mass on Thursday, November 4th, 2021 at 10 a.m. at the Mother of God Catholic Church in Denver, Colorado. Please join the family afterwards for a reception at Evolve Event Center, 2827 West 9th Avenue, Denver, 80204. To read the full obituary, please visit HoranCares.com. Virginia Lewis, January 6, 1929 to October 27, 2021. Virginia J. Lewis, 92, of Thornton, Colorado, passed away on October 27, 2021 in Thornton, Colorado. A memorial service will be held on Friday, November 5th at 2 p.m. at the Olinger Highland 10201 Grant Street, Thornton, Colorado. George J. Leidick, April 28, 1930 to October 30th, 2021. George J. Leidick of Denver, Colorado, passed away October 30th, 2021. Please visit FairmontFuneralHome.com for full obituary. Nancy Nem, July 18, 1938 to October 23, 2021. Nancy passed away October 23rd with her family by her side. The long goodbye is over. Mary Ellen Skinner, November 8, 1956 to October 16, 2021. Mary Ellen Skinner Dolan of Arvada, Colorado, was born in Denver, Colorado, to Miles and Loretta Dolan. She is survived by her sisters, Patricia Dolan and Diane Kress, husband Harry, daughters Brittany Skinner, Savannah Bermudez, husband Jamie, Rachel Skinner, and granddaughter Azalea. Services will be held at Family and Christ Community Church, 11355 Sheridan Boulevard, Westminster, 80020, on Friday, November 5th at 12 noon. Geraldine Zodro, October 7th, 1943 to October 27th, 2021. Geraldine Zodro passed away on October 27th, 2021 in Denver. She was born to Morris and Arlene Frederick Maggie in San Francisco, California on October 7, 1943, but spent most of her life most of her formative years in Dighton, Kansas. She began her career teaching in Colorado, but soon left to teach in Korea and Japan with the Department of Defense for several years. After returning to Colorado, she eventually worked for United Airlines, where she met Jack Zodro, and they were married in 1984. They remained married until his death in 1995. She then went on to finish her career working for the State Department of embassies all over the globe, including Russia, Turkey, Slovenia, Sweden, Italy, Ireland, and Poland, and took so much pride in that work. Her last assignment, after which she retired, was in Washington, D.C. Geraldine has many lifelong friends from her foreign service, many still living abroad. Many of her friends and family knew her as Geri. Throughout her life, she loved to sing, dance, attend live performances, and travel. She later in life, she also enjoyed playing bunco and was an avid reader and was president of her book club. She loved spending time with her many friends. Geri was a fun-loving person, enjoyed being silly, but also made those around her feel important. She will be missed by so many. Geri leaves behind her brother, Gerald, wife, Catherine, Maggie, niece, Anna, husband, Matt Walker, nephews, Josh, wife, Tawny, Maggie, Bobby, wife, Cindy, Maggie, and Matt, wife, Susan, Maggie, stepchildren, Lois, husband, Vic, Haddad, John, Zodro, Drew Zodro, Linda Kosler, Ann Zodro, Jean Zodro, and many great nieces and nephews, stepchildren, and step-grandchildren. Celebration of life to follow in Denver in the coming weeks, and more information will be found at fairmontfuneralhome.com. Donations in her memory can be made at PMGAwareness.org or KIF1A.org/. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Report on spending. Denverites enjoy fun, staying safe. More money went to entertainment, less to healthcare, by Aldo Svaldi, the Denver Post. Metro Denver households pulled down an extra $29,308 in income compared to the typical U.S. household in 2019 and 2020 and spent about $13,572 more. And how they divided up their spending diverged significantly in four key areas, according to the latest consumer expenditures report from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Households in the Denver, Aurora, Lakewood metropolitan areas spent an average of $75,760 in 2019 and 2020 compared to $62,188 for U.S. households, noted BLS Regional Commissioner Michael Hemiak in the report. That works out to Denver area households spending $1.22 for every $1 spent in a typical U.S. household. In about four of the eight major spending categories of spending, Denver area households divided slices of the spending pie similar to the rest of the country, including housing at 34.3%, transportation at 16.8%, and education and cash contributions or donations at 3% each. In four key areas, spending did vary in a statistically different way. Healthcare accounted for 7.5% of spending among Denver area households, compared to 8.3% of spending nationally. That could reflect a slightly younger population in the Denver sample, but Colorado has consistently boasted the state with the lowest obesity rate, so it could also represent a payoff for staying healthier. Denver area households also show a work hard, play hard ethic, devoting a higher share of spending to entertainment, 6.2% versus 4.9% for the country as a whole. They matched U.S. households in devoting 0.9% of spending to alcohol, but directed a smaller share of spending to tobacco and related products, 0.3% versus 0.5%. The heavier emphasis on entertainment spending doesn't mean they aren't also future-focused. Denver area households concentrated more spending on personal insurance and pensions at 13% of total spending versus 11.6% nationally. That category measures the money set aside to deal with contingencies in retirement. Everyone has to eat, but Denver area households devote less of their spending to that category than any major metro study outside of Dallas. Food accounts for 10.3% of spending in Denver versus 12.5% of household spending nationally. The cities where residents devote the largest share of their budgets to food are Honolulu at 16.3%, Atlanta at 15%, and Tampa, Florida, and Anchorage at 14.1%. Rental cars. Musk says Tesla has not signed a deal with Hertz yet. By Niraj Chakoski, the New York Times Company. Tesla's chief executive, Elon Musk, said Monday that the electric vehicle manufacturer had not yet signed a contract with Hertz to sell the car rental agency 100,000 of its vehicles, a deal that was announced last week as Tesla's stock value pushed past $1 trillion for the first time. Musk made the comment on Twitter late Monday in response to a user who had posted a chart depicting Tesla's skyrocketing stock price. If any of this is based on Hertz, I'd like to emphasize that no contract has been signed yet, he said. Tesla has far more demand than production, therefore we will only sell cars to Hertz for the same margin as to consumers. Hertz deal has zero effect on our economics. Tesla's shares tumbled Tuesday following as much as 4% in afternoon trading. A Hertz spokeswoman affirmed last week's announcement. Hertz has made an initial order of 100,000 Tesla electric vehicles and is investing in new EV charging infrastructure across the company's global operations, Hertz Communications Director Lauren Luster said in a statement. Deliveries of the Teslas already have been started. We are seeing very strong early demand for Teslas in our rental fleet, which reflects market demand for Tesla vehicles. The car rental agency's order for 100,000 Tesla vehicles represented a bold move for a business just out of bankruptcy and a sign of growing momentum behind a shift away from gas-powered vehicles. The cars were to be sold at list price, Musk said. Tesla's share price has continued to rise since the announcement, and stock in the company is now valued at a collective $1.2 trillion. After announcing the deal with Tesla, Hertz said it had also teamed with Uber, the rideshare company, to rent about 50,000 Tesla vehicles to its drivers. Guilty pleasures. Relive your favorite food memories with these throwback restaurant menus by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. A few months into the pandemic, chefs and restaurant owners started to realize and at various paces come to terms with it. Their fancy food just didn't travel well. They had been selling their fresh tossed pastas, perfectly roasted fish, and plates drizzled in reductions, and then all of a sudden it made much more sense to offer, say, take and bake lasagna, crispy chicken tenders, and lots of portable dipping sauces. These comfort foods got many restaurants through the pandemic, and for some, are now changing the way they do business. Look around Denver and the menus are filled with items that are nostalgic, creative, and also a bit ironic. The cocktails are nodding back to the later part of the 20th century, which with plays on frozen daiquiris, espresso martinis, and cosmopolitans. The happy hour specials are straight from fast food and even convenience stores. Cheesy Gordo crunches, soft-served blenders, and Frito pie bags. Turns out these are great levelers, the foods and drinks that unite customers, kitchen, and bar staff. It's what everybody actually wants to eat or drink when they clock out. For one Denver-based restaurant group, the shift in taste led its owners to shutter a fine dining French concept transition, the kitchen, to prepare buckets of fried chicken and feeding first responders, and finally to reopen later this month as a throwback steak joint. As a group, we're really good at doing polished casual, said Juan Padro, co-owner of A5, which will soon debut downtown in the former home of Morin and Wazi Supper Club before that. It's about being inspired by something and making it better, using the best ingredients and having fun with it, and appealing to somebody's childhood or some experience that they associate with. For Padro, those associations are a mashup of his Puerto Rican heritage and childhood in Massachusetts. Traditional foods like rice and beans are the ultimate comfort, he said, but so are Italian-American staples like meatballs and garlic bread or chicken parmesan, and you'll find versions of all of them at the Culinary Creative Group's restaurants. One staple across restaurants is a frozen cocktail made in the type of countertop slushy machine you might have come across at gas stations, snack bars, or movie theaters. Pedro says growing up, his dad used to make him a version typical of Latin American countries with just blended ice and pineapple. But most customers will think of the beach when they see a congelado del día on the menus at Denver's Señor Bear and Mr. Oso. It's so cheesy, but it works, Pedro said. The only thing you want when you go into the Caribbean is a frozen daiquiri or a piña colada, not a big Napa Cabernet, and I think people want to be transported, especially now. The combination of taking diners somewhere else in space and time is a sweet spot at the downtown bar Run for the Roses, which sends its customers through an alleyway and down an elevator before arriving in the underground digs, where they can feel entirely apart from 2021 and Denver. For owner Stephen Waters, classic drinks are especially, and any comebacks therein, like espresso martinis and cosmopolitans, are absolutely welcome. He also imagines those unnecessarily elaborate 90s-era cocktails, think Sex on the Beach, Alabama Slammer, coming back around soon. Even if people have no idea what's actually in them, and Waters takes the nostalgia to another level with hors d'oeuvres that combine high and low things like a bag of potato chips served with caviar, a platter of deviled eggs and shrimp cocktail. As customers are coming back to drinking and indoors, the bar is slowly reintroducing its food menu and trying to conjure the atmosphere of a dressed-up diner party, a dressed-up dinner party, Waters said. It's a vibe that could strike a perfect balance for restaurant goers coming out of the pandemic. It's also the scene that Pedro envisions of A5, where he hopes to see big groups gathered around a table full of bygone indulgences, think seafood towers, and everyone just chowing down on lobster tails or Denver steaks and modern wedge salads. Where we live is important to us. Our community is important to us, Pedro said. We don't want to force stuff on them. Here are some guilty pleasures we've noticed on menus and where to find them. Bologna sandwiches are best when fried and topped with mustard, mayo, iceberg lettuce, and potato chips, all between two slices of grilled white bread at Misfit Snack Bar. Cheesecake may never go out of style, but we're seeing it on dessert menus old and new and with distinct interpretations. For example, try out Barolo Grill's fanciful Castel Magno version of the Greenwich's New York Basque indulgence. Chicken tenders had a real resurgence during the pandemic with a pop-up that's becoming permanent at the former Lola Coastal Mexican, soon to be the Post Chicken and Beer in Lohi. Also, try them at Knockabout Burgers at Denver's Avanti Food Hall. Cosmopolitans are having a moment for the first time since Sex and the City. Order one at Benzina on East Colfax Avenue. Deviled eggs are a holiday tradition, but try popping in like palate cleansers between sips of martinis at Run for the Roses. Espresso martinis are what kicked off the 90s specific food trend in a big way this year. Go to Run for the Roses or Restaurant Olivia. Frito pies were once reserved for barbecue gatherings and sporting events in Texas and the Southwest. Now you can get them around Denver, including Vaca Gordo BBQ and Mr. Oso. Frozen cocktails are a dime a dozen these days in Denver. For Latin American versions, Señor Bear and Mr. Oso change theirs daily. for wine slushies, Akovas are a Highland neighborhood staple. Gorditas, a la Taco Bell, are perhaps our favorite of the fast food replicas. These crunchy, cheesy, happy hour snacks can be ordered at Senior Bear and Mr. Ozo. Seafood towers are back like inflation, and A5's version sure looks astronomical. Save the lobster tails and oyster platters for a blowout holiday dinner. Soft serve at Dang is made better with a side of French fries. Think Summers at the Pool Snack Bar, but better. And Knockabout Burgers makes milkshakes and seasonal blenders that draw their inspiration from fast food classics like Dairy Queen, Sonic, and Starbucks. White bread sandwiches get a glow up in the 2020s with the help of Japanese shakopan or milk bread. For a delicious selection of chef-made sandos on local enchanted oven slices, try Open, located inside Goose Town Tavern. Domestic policy proposal. Dems reach drug price deal, Biden upbeat on mansion, by Lisa Mascaro and Farnoosh Amiri, the Associated Press, Washington. Democrats reached an agreement Tuesday on a plan to lower prescription drug costs for most older people, capping out of pocket Medicare costs at $2,000 and reducing the price of insulin, salvaging a campaign promise as part of President Joe Biden's $1.75 trillion domestic policy proposal. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the deal, which is one of the few remaining provisions that needed to be resolved in Biden's big package as the party moves closer to wrapping up negotiations. Schumer acknowledged it's not as sweeping as Democrats had hoped for, but a compromise struck with one key holdout, Democrat Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. And Biden sounded upbeat about winning overall backing from another holdout, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who threw the president's plan in flux this week by refusing to endorse it. "He will vote for this," Biden said of Manchin during remarks at a global climate summit in Scotland. Without divulging their private conversations, Biden said the senator was looking at the fine print of the legislation, but I think we'll get there, the president said. The Democrats are rushing to overcome party battles and finish a final draft of Biden's plan. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had hoped to wrap up the draft and pave the way for voting as soon as Thursday on the overall package, according to her remarks at a closed-door caucus meeting. However, no votes have been scheduled. Fingers are pointing all around as negotiations over Biden's ambitious package have dragged on, with Democrats unable to pass the bill. Progressive and centrist lawmakers, particularly Manchin and Sinema, have fought over deals of the sprawling 1,600-page package. "I think what most people think, the situation is like, okay, we elected Democrats to have the majority in the House and Senate and the presidency. They should be getting things done," Democratic Rep. Elaine Luria, who represents a swing district in Virginia, told reporters at the Capitol. Schumer said that for the first time, Medicare will be able to negotiate prescription drug prices on its Part B and Part D programs. The $2,000 cap on out-of-pocket costs would benefit those older Americans and the Part D prescription drug benefit, who number some 48 million, Democrats said. Also, the insulin prices would fall from as high as $600 a dose to $35. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
Colorado's safety net health centers are on a fast track to bring more people of color and those living in rural areas into good-paying healthcare jobs. Sarah McCrander with the Colorado Community Health Network says a new grant from SyncUp Colorado will allow health centers to develop staff that are connected to their communities and patients.
Because we know that when people receive care from people that look like them or from the community that they live in, the care and the health outcomes improve.
The Grow Our Own initiative will give clinics tools to connect with youths from historically underrepresented communities and help them make important first steps toward health careers they may not have seen as possible. Anyone interested in joining the program, which will initially focus on recruiting medical assistants, can find more information at missiondrivencareers.org. Nearly 9 in 10 new jobs in Colorado require a post-secondary degree, but just 58% of residents have a professional certificate or college degree. Two-thirds of graduates also end up with significant student loan debt. McCrander says by teaming up with colleges and universities, students will be able to earn decent wages as they work toward a range of certificates and degrees.
Say you're a radiology tech and you've done a certification through that you'll be able to apply some of those credits that you earned through that certification program to a future bachelor degree.
Grow Our Own was one of 6 winning partnerships using modern apprenticeships and hybrid college approaches to increase student access to the state's fastest growing industries that pay a living wage, including healthcare and construction. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that anyone can apply for Health First Colorado, Medicaid, or CHP Plus benefits? Go to co.gov/PEAK, apply in person at your county of residence, or call 1-800-221-3943. Again, that phone number is 1-800-221-3943-TTY-711. Most Health First Colorado and CHP Plus members are automatically enrolled for dental benefits. Undocumented persons can apply for Medicaid or CHP Plus for their documented children. A Social Security number or legal permanent resident ID needs to be provided for the household members that are applying for benefits. The person completing the application is asked for their Social Security number, but it is not required. This message brought to you by DentaQuest, Administrator of Health First Colorado Medicaid, and the CHP Plus Dental Programs. For information about your DentaQuest dental benefits, finding a provider, to request a replacement dental ID card, or need help scheduling an appointment, Health First Colorado members call 1-855-225-1729. Again, that phone number is 1-855-225-1729, TTY-711, and CHP Plus members call 1-888-307-6561. Again, that's 1-888-307-6561, TTY-711, or visit us at dentaquest.com/Colorado. For replacement dental ID cards, members can also create an account or log into the member portal at dentaquest.com/Colorado.
Arapahoe County's Department of Human Services offers several financial assistance programs to help the elderly and disabled. Each program has different requirements for eligibility. The following programs are offered: Aid to the Needy and Disabled, a financial assistance program for disabled individuals unable to work; Food Assistance, General Assistance for Emergency Situations; Long-Term Care; Low-Income Energy Assistance Program; and Old Age Pension. For information on how to apply for any of these programs, call 303-636-1170. To learn about other services that may be available to seniors in the county, please contact Arapahoe County's Senior Resources Division at 303-738-8080.